Tonight's topic, contraception. And the first thing I wanted to talk about with this topic is just the etymology of the word. Contra, we know, is the prefix for against something. Inception, we hear in that, you know, like inception, like the beginning. So we're talking about going against the beginning of something. And what that beginning is fertilization, ensoulment, all of those other terms that we would use. And so what the church, when we talk about contraception, we're not principally talking about one particular mechanism. There are various different kinds of contraception, which we'll get into a little bit. But at the end of the day, it's really a mentality. It's really having an intention to go against the beginning of life. And I say that because this is different from regulating birth. And I want to make that distinction right in the beginning because the church teaches and always has taught that we are supposed to be, that parents are supposed to be responsible in having children and raising children. And yes, the Catholic Church has always taught, you know, generally we joke about, you know, Catholic families are huge, you know, and we should be open to God giving us as many children as he wants to give us, and we joke about that. But the church also teaches, of course, that we need to be responsible. And, you know, if a husband and wife decide that perhaps in the present situation they simply can't have another kid because of what's going on in the world, maybe they're in the middle of a war zone, or their own personal finances, or this reason or that reason, or perhaps they have another kid who's special needs that's going to need a lot of their time, or whatever the reason is, the church says that that's fine for parents to have those reasons to regulate birth, but it can't be contraceptive. And again, that's where this mentality comes in. It can't be a contraceptive mentality. That's why, number one, it's perfectly all right to just abstain. You know, and I think you mention that sometimes to married couples or even to not married couples, and they have this idea that, well, we just have to have sex. Like, you know, we're going to explode if we don't have sex. And it's like, well, no, that doesn't happen. Thank God for celibacy, you know. A living example that you will not explode. But sometimes people are so off-put by that, like, well, how dare you suggest that, you know, we should abstain? Well, yeah, and you know, and do married couples have a right to sex? Yes and no. It is reserved for marriage, and married couples are supposed to engage in it, and we're going to get into this a little bit more in a minute. But it's not like a right you have to just do as much as you want, however you want. You know what I mean? So there is something to be said about a responsible parenthood in terms of regulating birth. So parents can regulate birth, but again, it cannot be contraceptive. And we're going to get into what exactly that means. And just as a side note, of course, natural family planning is, at least right now, it seems, other than simply abstaining, really the only legit means out there of regulating birth in such a way that it is not contraceptive. And just to throw you some statistics about NFP, natural family planning, it's actually more effective in terms of, for a couple who uses NFP to prevent pregnancy, it's actually more effective than any other form of birth control, statistically speaking, when it's used properly. And yes, it does take a little bit of effort, but when it's done correctly and used properly, it is more effective than any other form of birth control out there, be it a barrier method, a chemical method, whatever. And again, we're going to get into that too. Interestingly enough, NFP is also used by, there are just as many people using NFP who are using it to not get pregnant as there are people who are using it to get pregnant. Couples who are trying to achieve pregnancy and they've been told to use NFP so that they know exactly like the day or two to try to conceive. So it's interesting that connection there. And lest you think that we don't, that priests and seminarians, and Scott can attest to this, don't get any amount of training in this, we have to go through all sorts of very detailed training with NFP, how it works. We often joke that, like, you practically had to get a degree in gynecology to graduate the seminary. I mean, in terms of just knowing all of these different things, which is good for priests to know because you have, but I know some people also write off a priest and say, well, what do you know? You're celibate, which is why I also like to refer people to couples who are practicing NFP. And one of the things I've been trying to put together recently is a list of parishioners right here in Sacred Heart who are practicing NFP regularly and who have volunteered to be on a list that would be made public, and basically to say, look, if you ever have questions or you want to know more about a couple who's actually using it, you can talk to us. And I have about 10 couples or so on that list already, and I'm sure there are many other couples in the parish using NFP, I hope. They're not contracepting. But if that's something you, any of you would be interested in, I can provide that to you privately later. But we do have that list. Again, these are all people who have volunteered and self-identified as using NFP. And again, it is a bit of, you know, it does take a little bit of work, but again, when it's used, it is so much more effective than any other form of birth control out there. So, why does the church say contraception is wrong? And again, it's not regulating birth is wrong, it's contraception. Why is contraception wrong? And I want to begin with just a little bit of history. Do you know that for 1930 years, every Christian denomination, Catholic, Protestant, whatever, all the way up until 1930, taught against contraception? It wasn't until the Lambeth Conference in 1930. The Lambeth Conference is a group of, it's the, I guess you'd call it decennial, or every 10 years, the Anglican Conference would get together every 10 years and basically have a big council and discuss things and publish resolutions and whatnot. And it wasn't until that conference in 1930 when the Anglican Church got together and for the very first time in the whole history of Christianity actually allowed contraception. Now, granted, it was in very limited circumstances. It was only with marriage and only under very particular circumstances. So, I mean, just to give them credit, it was not, you know, anyone can use this for casual sex or whatever. It was very limited. But, you know, the saying goes, you start chipping away and, you know, it just all comes apart. And we see that happening, especially to the Anglicans and Episcopalians, that, you know, now you can do and believe anything as an Episcopalian, you know, and that's why so many of them, thank God, are coming home to the Catholic Church in droves, you know. In fact, later this year, it's expected to establish finally this ordinariate. This is kind of a side topic, but you heard how Benedict XVI established these ordinariates for former Anglicans to come into full communion with the Catholic Church and to still maintain a lot of their Anglican traditions and patrimony and whatnot, but to be fully Catholic. And it's, we have two parishes right in Maryland that are, the entire parish is converting. And later within this next year, it's expected that over 100 priests, over 100 Anglican Episcopalian clergy are converting, and God willing, will be ordained Catholic priests. So you see what happens. So this was 1930. This was the very first time any Christian denomination anywhere allowed contraception. Now, yes, granted, it was in a very limited circumstance, but allowed nonetheless. So that was the very first time. And again, we've seen what's happened since then. Because after you allow it within marriage under certain circumstances, then it's like, well, what about these other circumstances? And then what about outside of marriage? And then boom, 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 boom. You know, it becomes a very slippery slope. So the Catholic, the big Catholic document that's often pointed to is Pope Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae. It's Latin for human life. Which was 1967, Scott, 1967, I think. And basically one of the things, and this was a big document when you might remember when it came out. I was not alive, thank God. thank God that I didn't live through the 60s or the 70s and or most of the 80s. And a lot of people were kind of thinking the Pope was not going to say what he did. A lot of Catholics were thinking that when this document came out, they knew that this document was coming from Rome and it was going to be on contraception. They were kind of wondering, what's the church going to say? And he came out flat against it. And there was this rebellion in this diocese, a rebellion of priests even, and the archbishop at the time, Cardinal Laboyle, you might remember, actually suspended about a third of the presbyterate, about a third of the priests revoked their faculties, because they kind of got together and said, well, if we stick together, if there are enough of us, what can he do? And, well, he suspended them all. So that was right in our own diocese, in our own backyard. It's a very sad part of our history. But what this document basically said, the gist of it, is that for sex to really be sex, it needs to have two dimensions, and these two dimensions need to be simultaneously present. And those two dimensions are the unitive dimension and the procreative dimension. So again, they need to be simultaneously present for sex to be sex. And we're going to get into a little bit more of that in a minute here. Now, what this does not mean, as so many people think the Catholic Church teaches, is that like every time you have sex, you have to like be planning on getting pregnant or something. That's not what the Church teaches. The Church teaches that those two dimensions need to be present, meaning that they at least need to not be blocked. They need to be present, and that's why something like NFP is completely legitimate, because it does not block, it does not prevent the creative dimension. And that's why even people who tell you, you know, I mean, as effective as NFP is, it is not 100% effective, and it's for that very reason, because there is no absolute certainty that you won't get pregnant. Again, it's much more effective than any other forms of birth control, which often will fail for other reasons, again, be it chemical methods or physical barrier methods. But they need to not be blocked. Those two dimensions need to be present at the same time. As the saying goes, you can't separate love-making from life-making. The two of them need to be present simultaneously. And the two dimensions are linked. Think about this. So the unitive dimension, meaning sex is supposed to, you know, supposed to be a type of making love. It's supposed to draw the couple together. But think about it this way. This is kind of what links the dimensions, is for sex to not be a lie, and Dr. Janet Smith talks a little bit about this in her CD, for sex to not be a lie, because what are you doing when you're having sex? You're saying to the other person, I give myself to you entirely in such a way that I don't give to anyone else. I'm giving myself entirely to you. We're going to do this very intimate thing that I don't do with anyone else, and I pray God you don't do with anything else, with anyone else. And this is also why the Church teaches as a side issue that, you know, sex is reserved for marriage, you know, that it can't just be, oh, well, we love each other very much and we're going to get married. But no, this is within an already established bond, an exclusive union, right? But then think about it. If you're saying to the other person, which you essentially are by having sex with them, that I give myself entirely to you, but not this part of me, you know, I give myself entirely to you, but not my reproductive ability, which is part of me, you know, then how are you giving yourself entirely to the other person if you're not giving them your whole being? You know, so these two dimensions, the love-making and life-making, the procreative and the unitive dimensions, are so closely linked, because for you to give yourself entirely to the other person, that means everything that means every part of who you are. So, now this link between the unitive and procreative dimensions, this is also why so many other things the Church teaches against. Now, these things that I'm going to name off here, there are also other reasons why the Church teaches against these, but this is one of them. So, for instance, in vitro fertilization, you know, people look at something like that and they say, well, wait a minute, the Church is pro-family and pro-baby and, you know, wants you to have kids, and so what's wrong with in vitro fertilization? You know, because you're still separating the unitive and the procreative dimension. And they're not simultaneously present. They might both be present, but they're not simultaneously present. You might have this couple having sex, but then later on, either through some illicit way or whatever, then we try to we extract the eggs and somehow we get the sperm and we join them over here in vitro. It's Latin for in glass, in little glass tubes. And there are so many other reasons why in vitro fertilization is wrong. One of them, for instance, is because generally the practice is they usually will take out about 20 or so eggs from the woman, and they will fertilize them all at once. They'll keep all of them on ice and implant 3 or 4 at a time, hoping that eventually one of them will catch. And they keep implanting them until one of them does catch. And catch, I should use a better word, actually implant and grow, you know. And then the problem, too, is we have problems with both sides of this. One extreme is that it implants right away, and, well, now we have to do, you know, selective termination. Now we have to get rid of, because we can't have four kids, so let's look at the one that looks healthiest, and let's get rid of the other three that we implanted. Oh, and what about the other 16 on ice? Well, we'll get rid of them, too. I mean, those are all human souls there. Those are your children. So again, those are other reasons why IVF is wrong, but one of them is because, again, you're separating the unity from the procreative dimension. Again, this is also why surrogacy is wrong. And again, a lot of this I know that people are just ignorant on, so I'm not saying that people who do this are like going to hell or anything like that. I'm saying there's objective wrong here, and there may be completely subjective innocence if they just don't know, you know. So let's make that distinction too. But same thing with surrogacy. You know, we're separating the unitive from the procreative dimensions. Again, homosexual acts. Again, there are other reasons why homosexual acts are wrong, but this is one of them, because is there really, there certainly isn't a creative dimension there, because no matter how you do it, two guys or two girls can't have kids. And you could make a very strong case that there's not really a unitive dimension there either. This is also why other sexual acts, not even within marriage, that don't result in the marital embrace, I think you all know what I mean, that's why those are also wrong. Because people often wonder, like, what does the church teach about something like foreplay or this or that or whatever? And the church's teaching is, so long as it ends in the marital embrace being what the marital embrace is supposed to be, that's fine, you know. As Chris West puts it, there's this great Catholic apologist, Chris West, who has published all sorts of books in which he explains John Paul II's theology of the body and whatever else. He talks about this a little bit, and it's kind of a touchy topic, but no pun intended. He talks about foreplay, and he talks about how no part of the human body is unkissable. That, a weird way of putting it, but that these kinds of acts within marriage, again, within marriage, are okay so long as they are ultimately leading to completion as it should be, you know, in the marital embrace, okay? So I think I've said enough about that. And this is also why sterilization is wrong. Now, we're going to come back to sterilization in a minute because there's a little caveat I have to say about that. But again, you're separating, you know, the unitive and the procreative dimension. So, so just keep that in mind, that what Paul VI said in Humanae Vitae was that for sex to be sex, for it to be what it's supposed to be, those two dimensions, lovemaking and life-making, need to be present simultaneously, right? And again, I can't encourage you enough to listen to the CD by Dr. Janet Smith, because she talks about some predictions that Pope Paul VI made. Again, this was 40 years ago, but he had made some predictions, and I'm not going to get into it all now because you can listen to it on the CD, but he had made some predictions about what the world would be like if contraception became readily available, as it has today. Every single one of those predictions has come true. So I'll let you listen to that and delve into that a little bit more. And then let me just say something about the types of contraception here, some little caveats that need to be said. When we talk about the physical barrier methods of contraception, I think it's very clear when you're talking to someone and trying to talk them out of using contraception, it's very clear to be able to look at that and say, look, you are obviously putting a physical barrier between the two of you. You know, how are you really giving yourself entirely to the other person, which is what you are saying with your body when you have sex, if there is this physical blockade between the two of you, right? But, of course, we know that, and those are often very prone to fail and everything else. But now what about the chemical types of contraception? Because people will say, well, with that, there is no physical barrier, and that's true. But there are some other issues with the chemical types of contraception. One of those issues, you know, of course, is that they can sometimes act as an abortifacient. And an abortifacient, as you may or may not know, An abortifacient is something that causes an abortion, essentially, because it can function after after conception, after fertilization has occurred. I'm thinking of like Plan B, for instance, as it's called, that pill Plan B, the emergency over the counter. It's now over the counter. You have to be 18 to buy it, but it's still over the counter. And this can function as an abortifacient. Now, in their defense, it does not always function as an abortifacient. It can also just function as a plain old contraceptive. But what does it do? It functions in three different ways, the Plan B pill. It stops ovulation from occurring. It increases the density and makeup of the vaginal mucus so that if the sperm is still on the way, it's blocked from getting there. And the third thing it does is it instantly causes the shedding of the endometrium, the uterine lining. And that's the function that can actually work as an abortifacient, because if conception has already occurred, and it has potentially already implanted in the uterine wall, well, now it's out. Now, again, it does not always function as an abortifacient. If conception has not already occurred, it can prevent it from occurring, but again, conception can occur within a few day window there. So this is some of the problems with some of the chemical forms of contraception. And I want to say something about this too, is the effects. There have been some interesting studies done recently, and I don't want to dwell too much on this, but there have been some interesting studies done recently on the effects that chemical contraceptives have had on men and women. They did, what was it called? It was called like the T-shirt test. Have you guys heard about this? I'm sorry, Karen. The T-shirt test. It was, what they did was basically what they were noticing was that women on contraception, on the pill, it basically made them lower their standards when it came to seeking out a mate. That it actually lowered women's instinctual standards. That instead of looking for, you know, and again, this is subconscious, but instead of looking for, you know, a strong masculine guy who will be able to be a good father and a good provider and blah 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 blah, that it kind of it made them look for just, you know, something less than that, you know. It had all sorts of effects on the women, but then the other thing it did too was they had Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't they have the men, they had the women smell T-shirts worn by men, right? And they did different men wearing these T-shirts and just sweating, and just this is all like pheromones and kind of stuff. And the women were like consistently attracted to like the ones that were how do we say, less than ideal candidates for fatherhood and, you know, marriage. Yeah, it is. But it's interesting. It's interesting how the chemicals can function on your pheromones like this. You know. And there was also a test done with, was it monkeys or?
Yeah, monkeys.
And basically what they did was they gave contraception, they put something like the female monkeys on contraception, and all of a sudden the male monkeys were like no longer attracted to them. And didn't some of the males actually start engaging in homosexual acts?
That's true.
Because, again, strictly pheromones, they were so turned off, they were not doing what nature tells them to do. Which is to procreate. So there's so much going on here that I think we haven't seen the end on this. I think we're going to continue to see much more on this, on the effects of the chemical contraception, the effects of it on men and women, how that, and again, it's all subconscious. It's not like you would know that this is happening. And then finally, the other type of contraception that I said I would come back to is kind of a caveat. And I think I'll wrap up with this because it has been almost a half an hour, and I try to talk for just a half an hour and then let you guys ask your questions. But sterilization. Now, can sterilization be done in a contraceptive mentality? Yes. But there are also instances where it has been done for non-contraceptive reasons. And that's why the church is very careful when we talk about sterilization. A classic example that's often used in moral theology is, you know, the woman with ovarian cancer. You know, the only way to, well, not the only way, but often the only way of treating it is simply to remove them, you know. Now, of course, when you do this, you are sterilizing her, but that's not your intention. We talk about this as the doctrine of double effect. Thomas Aquinas talked a lot about this. My intention is not to sterilize. My intention is to remove the cancer. And I foresee, and I know, that in removing the cancer, this woman is now going to be sterilized, but that is not my intention. And so even though I can foresee it, and it's not like, oh, it might happen. No, it's going to happen. If you remove her ovaries, she's going to be sterile. But my intention is not to do that. My intention is simply to remove the cancer. Now, of course, if there are other ways of getting rid of the cancer, if it's in an early enough stage or whatever, and you're able to do chemo or whatever else, then fine. And there are other situations, too, with sterilization, again, testicular cancer or those kinds of things as well. And another situation that's also mentioned is, you know, women who have had too many cesarean sections that they're told basically do not get pregnant again because you've been cut open so many times now that if you do get pregnant again, you're simply going to burst open. That happened to my own mother. She had 5 cesarean sections. And they'll tell you, like, don't get pregnant again. And sometimes women will react to that by saying, well, you know, one of the two of us is going to get sterilized. So there's that issue too. Now again, we're not justifying that, but my point is that I don't want to simply write that off as, you know, again, I'm not condemning people to hell. I'm not even saying that there's necessarily sin involved. Obviously, for there to be sin, you need to know that it's wrong. And so often with these things, there's just ignorance. People don't know. So that is everything I wanted to say. So I will be happy to take any questions. And again, there were some other things that I had kind of wanted to get into, but I figured Dr. Janet Smith says it much better than me, so please listen to her CD.